This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Hydrogen is the most abundant chemical substance in the universe. It constitutes approximately 75% of the universe's mass, but it must be approaching 100% of the media's interest in battery technology. The time is right to power up hydrogen, declared the editorial board of the Financial Times in July. Policymakers are already taking action. The EU published a hydrogen strategy over the summer, and Joe Biden speaks of carbon-free hydrogen in his manifesto. The market has evidently taken note of this commitment to hydrogen technology, with many companies specializing in hydrogen fuel cells seeing their share prices surge this year. The enthusiasm isn't universal, however. Last year, Elon Musk, who as Tesla's CEO knows something about batteries, warned that success was just not possible with hydrogen fuel cells. He has also said less kind things about them. Well, I'm joined now by Anand Venkatramanan, head of ETF investment strategies at Elgium, to discuss this fascinating topic. Anand, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Cool. So Anand, let's start with the notion that hydrogen fuel cells are environmentally friendly. It sounds intuitively true, and if it is correct, then you can imagine various other barriers to hydrogen being overcome. So, put simply, how green is hydrogen?
That's a great question, Rob. I mean, every time people think about hydrogen, the assumption is that it's entirely green, but it's to the contrary right now, actually. So hydrogen can be produced through electrolysis or from fossil fuels. And the technology that's used to produce hydrogen from fossil fuels is called as steam methane reforming. That's the most common technology that's used. And with that process, you are kind of producing hydrogen from something like methane or from coal. So if you take hydrogen produced from methane, for every ton of hydrogen that's produced through steam methane reforming process, about 10 tons of carbon dioxide is produced along with it. And if you produce hydrogen from coal, then you're looking at that to be about 19 tons of CO2 per ton of hydrogen. So clearly that has a very high carbon footprint, but of course, if you're able to capture that carbon and store them in kind of decommissioned oil wells and so on, we'll be contributing to less CO2 or have a lower carbon footprint when it comes to the atmospheric carbon dioxide levels. So now, if you move away from that, the most green process to produce hydrogen would be electrolysis. That is basically passing electricity through water, and then you end up getting hydrogen on one end and oxygen on the other. And if you are able to kind of store that hydrogen, then that would be green. Of course, as long as the electricity that's used to produce that hydrogen comes from green sources as well. There's no point producing electricity from coal and then using that to produce hydrogen, because then net-net, you are kind of going to have a high carbon footprint. It only makes sense if your electricity itself is from green sources, and if you're able to use that to produce hydrogen through electrolysis, then that's what you would call as a carbon-free green hydrogen. Of course, its weakness is that, transformation from electricity to hydrogen requires electrolysis, and that ends up having substantial energy losses today as we speak. But of course, as technology improves, we'll see that getting better and the efficiency of that improving. So I'd just like to kind of highlight an interesting stat there, that according to International Renewable Energy Agency, the cost of electrolyzers is expected to decrease by 50% by 2040 to 2050, and that's kind of a good thing to look out for over the next decade or two.
Okay, thank you, Anand. So the price will come down, we expect, but just how much more expensive is this green hydrogen today?
Well, different research experts peg that at different numbers. Of course, if you look at someone like California Fuel Cell Partnership, they peg green hydrogen fuel prices to be around about just under $14 per kilogram. That corresponds to about, I would say, $5.6 per gallon of gasoline, if you want to equate that with your fossil fuels at the moment. Now, you know, US gasoline prices, as we know, are roughly around, you know, $2 per gasoline, and that, $2 per gallon. And that makes it about, I would say, just under three times more expensive when compared to internal combustion engine car driven by petrol. But of course, when you look at, you know, someone like Global Data, who's a research firm whom we work with for another thematic fund, they're also a FTSE 250 listed firm, and they peg that figure at about half of what California Fuel Cell Partnership pegged that at. And Global Data reckons that's around $6 per kilogram. And now, on the other hand, when you look at what Hydrogen Council, a global CEO-led initiative of 81 leading companies, say, they estimate that fuel cell passenger vehicles could only become viable when hydrogen prices average around $2 per kilogram. So that means we've still got some distance to cover here. Even when you look at the most aggressive estimates of hydrogen costs, that's still about three times that level that Hydrogen Council requires price of hydrogen to be for on par costs with internal combustion engines. But of course, when you look at the more conservative costs pegged by, say, someone like California Fuel Cell Partnership, then we're seeing that number at about seven times more than what would be needed for the commercial viability of fuel cell cars.
Yes, I see. Thank you. We do still have a way to go until green hydrogen is competitive. But presuming that does happen through technological developments, can you see a time when hydrogen fuel cells do become the dominant battery technology?
Well, perhaps yes, but there are quite a few hurdles to overcome and challenges to meet. First, you know, when you look at hydrogen, you need to, in order to produce that, as I mentioned, there are two common technologies or processes that you can employ today, the steam methane reforming or electrolysis. So when you look at either of these, you need energy to produce. And then once you produce hydrogen, you need to store them. And most often, you know, storage is done through compression, either by, you know, through a compressed gas or liquefied hydrogen. And that requires energy to compress the gas. And the third step is to transport them. If you were to transport compressed gas, you need tankers. And if you were to transport, you know, hydrogen in its natural gaseous state, you need pipelines. So we don't have that infrastructure at all. We could potentially leverage natural gas pipelines today, but that's not going to be sufficient because now you've got heating requirements to meet as well. So unless you kind of turn the natural gas tap off and entirely switch to hydrogen, I don't see those existing natural gas pipelines to be deployed for the purposes of transporting hydrogen. So there's a huge, you know, lack of infrastructure for transportation. And also because of, you know, energy efficiency losses at each step, you know, be it production, be it storage, be it transportation, you're talking about, you know, that pretty much pushing the I would say the time at which hydrogen could, you know, potentially see commercial viability when it comes to, you know, light passenger vehicles. But of course, you know, when you look at more heavier point-to-point transportation solutions or industrial vehicles, you know, if you take forklifts or if you take trucks that go from one point to another, then potentially hydrogen could, you know, gain a bit of market share over the next decade or two. But of course, we don't see that to sort of dominate even that industry. But of course, you know, batteries will still continue to dominate because, you know, you're able to leverage existing grid infrastructure to charge the batteries. But at the same time, that their technology is far more advanced. And when it comes to a cost and energy density perspective, they are, you know, pretty close to that, you know, break-even point versus petrol and diesel vehicles. So I would say a bit more distance to cover, or rather some more distance to cover for hydrogens before they become, you know, commercially viable.
Thank you. And as well as those distribution infrastructure and the cost challenges, you mentioned that there are some efficiency losses associated with hydrogen fuel cells. So just how inefficient are those fuel cells compared with other types of battery?
Well, that's a very interesting question, right? So the efficiency losses come from two parts. One is the production, storage, and transportation of hydrogen. And the other is actually, how fuel cells work. Different experts, independent research experts, have different estimates of those losses. But clearly, when you look at, using electricity to directly store that in batteries and discharging that to run electric motors, that is a far more efficient process than, as I mentioned, for hydrogen, when you have the production of hydrogen, storage, transportation. And more importantly, when you look at the existing fuel cell technology as well. So if you use hydrogen to actually produce electricity through a fuel cell, that again produces heat. And when anytime a battery or a device or like fuel cell, if it produces heat, and that clearly means there are efficiency losses, because part of that energy that could be converted into electricity is being, lost as heat, which is, unusable for in that particular application. So fuel cells, again, are more heavier than what you would see in a battery powered electric vehicle, because you don't need something like a fuel cell to convert electricity, because batteries themselves discharge electricity in a usable form. Whereas with hydrogen based fuel cells, you need to use hydrogen and then go through that oxidation process to produce electricity through a fuel cell. So that leads to additional weight in a fuel cell powered car, and there are efficiency losses even at that conversion stage as well.
Right, yeah, thank you. And also, I suppose, as well as all these challenges for hydrogen fuel cells, the cost of production, the high carbon footprint, the lack of distribution infrastructure, and the loss of efficiency you just discussed, we shouldn't presume that other battery technologies will stay static while hydrogen catches up. What are you seeing among competing battery technologies?
That's a great point, Rob. When you look at hydrogen, there's been a lot of talk about it, clearly, as you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. But let's not assume that batteries are going to remain static. And you make a very pertinent point there. So when you look at the way batteries have evolved, of course, they've been around for about 150 years since Volta put a stack together. But in the last, I would say, 3 to 4 decades, there's been huge spending in terms of R&D, particularly in chemistries like lithium ion. But in the last decade or so, people are showing more interest in flow-based batteries, flow-based technology, and also sodium sulfur chemistries. So what is happening clearly, even within lithium ion chemistries, which you see dominate today's battery storage landscape, you see that there's a constant evolution of that technology as well. So you would have heard about lithium cobalt chemistries, thanks to Tesla for making that popular. But there are a variety of other chemistries as well. If you look at lithium iron phosphate, the energy density is clearly lower when compared to lithium manganese cobalt chemistry, but those batteries are cheaper to manufacture. So in countries where there could be kind of, which require lower economic thresholds for, entry points, then you could see that lithium iron phosphate chemistries could actually help those countries, move into this kind of or transition into electric vehicles rather than waiting for more expensive chemistries, right? So that's just on lithium ion chemistries. Now again, within that particular vertical, you've got chemistries where you have liquid electrolytes, semi-solid or polymer-based electrolytes, or solid electrolytes. And that is a very interesting development that we are seeing, and kind of most industry participants are kind of eagerly anticipating those that particular solid state technology to become more viable. Because with these, with solid state batteries, you replace the electrolyte, which could be liquid or semi-liquid, with a solid electrolyte. And what happens because of that is the size reduces, the weight reduces, the energy density increases, the number of charge cycles that you can actually achieve, increases multiple times, sometimes up to 5 or 6 times than your existing lithium ion technology. And your safety characteristics improve as well. And various experts, expect that to kind of hit the roads in a big way around mid-2020s. And when that happens, we'll see, I would say, exponential uptake of electric vehicles. And at the same time, because of the efficiencies, efficiency gains that these solid state batteries are able to bring.
Great. Thank you, Anand. That all sounds very exciting, and there are obviously lots of different technologies competing for market share in the battery world. But are there any areas where you can see hydrogen gaining more of an advantage in the near to medium term?
Yes, certainly, Rob. I think when it comes to hydrogen, as I mentioned earlier on, that could still, you know, see a bit of traction when it comes to industrial applications, you know, things like forklifts. You could use hydrogen to power forklifts, and as it's currently being done in certain parts of the world. Or you could see hydrogen being, you know, used for, you know, to power trucks. Because trucks have, you know, if you're talking about long haul trucks, they have kind of a more of a point to point model. And for those to refuel those trucks with hydrogen would only require building up the storage infrastructures in a smaller set of distribution points. So that would mean, you know, that could be achieved pretty fairly easily. And because of that, you could see hydrogen being used for, you know, trucks as well. But even then, you know, that said, if you take the overall, you know, market share of hydrogen when it comes to, say, trucks and industrial applications over the next 20 or 30 years, even then, that is only going to make a smaller percentage of the overall transportation market. So that's one thing. So yes, you know, hydrogen could see growth, but that would only, you know, in my view, that would only still make up only a smaller chunk of the overall transportation sector. But on the other hand, you know, when you look at, you know, colder countries, countries in colder climate zones, which heavily rely on natural gas to meet their heating requirements, increasingly experts believe that we could see hydrogen being blended into natural gas to sort of reduce the, you know, the amount of natural gas that's used or burned, but at the same time increase the consumption of hydrogen. But that comes with a bit of a, you know, word of caution as well, because you can only achieve, you know, commercial success there if the prices of electricity that is used to, you know, produce hydrogen through electrolysis become, you know, reduced to an extent that makes that green hydrogen cheaper than natural gas. If you are, you know, going to produce hydrogen using expensive electricity, then, you know, unless you want to kind of meet the CO2 emission targets, then, you know, it's not going to be, I would say, economically viable to go down that route. So yes, you know, certain applications, both when it comes to heating, meeting heating requirements, or I would say industrial transportation, or heavy transportation sectors, that could see some traction for hydrogen-based technology.
I see, thank you. Now, we've devoted a lot of time to hydrogen, but I think we shouldn't ignore the broader market for battery technology either. I think you can roughly divide that market into two segments, batteries for electric vehicles and batteries for large-scale grid storage. If we start with electric vehicles, we've discussed some of the different technologies competing to provide those batteries for those vehicles, but what demand trends are you seeing for electric vehicles themselves?
Well, I mean, in the last, I would say, 10 years or so since Tesla launched their, you know, original model in 2008, we've seen a huge shift in the market for electric vehicles. And of course, you know, everyone knows that. You see a lot of media articles on that as well, pretty much on a regular basis these days. And what drives the demand is clearly, you know, consumer preferences to switch to more greener sources of transportation. But at the same time, as we see battery costs becoming, you know, lower and lower, the break-even point for electric vehicles when it comes to the overall cost versus internal combustion engine driven cars, it's kind of getting closer and closer. Experts peg the break-even, you know, the magic figure at about $100 per kilowatt hour, and that's the price that we would want to achieve for batteries for electric cars to become on par with petrol and diesel vehicles. But that is you know, roughly about 5 years away, according to independent research experts, right? But that said, you know, when it comes to demand for electric vehicles, you know, you're seeing demand for electric cars, obviously, in many parts of the world. We're also seeing demand for electric two-wheelers and three-wheelers. You know, there are far more two and three-wheelers, electric two-wheelers and three-wheelers on this planet, far more than in electric cars as we speak today, right? But even when it comes to electric cars, you're seeing a healthy demand growth there. Yes, because of COVID, overall across the planet, we've seen muted demand for automobiles in general. But we've seen some of that demand bounce back in June and July. We're already starting to see some green shoots there across different parts of the globe. And as we see car prices to come, coming down, we'll see an increased demand uptake for that as well. And finally, I just want to also, point out that, governments across the globe are still providing some incentives in a variety of shapes and forms for these vehicles. Those incentives could either come as tax credit, or it could be subsidies, or it could be simple things like no congestion charge. Let's say if you take a place like London, or parking fees waived off and things like that. So you either have tax credits, you have subsidies, and so on. That is also still driving the demand to a certain extent. So I would say the parameters and indicators are still quite healthy for electric vehicles in general, and we hope that will continue over the coming years as well.
Thank you. So that's great news about demand for electric vehicles. But now in terms of grid storage using large-scale batteries, what kind of trends are you seeing at the moment?
That's quite interesting because, people hear a lot about electric vehicles, but something that's quite intangible in this day and age is the amount of batteries that's being consumed by grid storage facilities, right? And when we built our fund 3 years ago, the overall capacity, the global capacity for grid storage projects was roughly around 5 gigawatts. But since then, we've seen just around in 2018 and 19, the cumulative grid storage capacity that was installed just in these 2 years exceeded 6 gigawatts. Right, so the total capacity that was installed all the way up until 27 was exceeded by just 2 years. Right, so that is the rate of growth that we're seeing. So across the globe, we are expecting the grid storage market to grow at around 20 to 30% annually, and that would include both large scale grid storage applications and behind the meter storage facilities, right? So if you're talking about smaller residential homes or smaller establishments with solar panels on their roofs, then they might want to kind of store all that electricity into their behind the meter battery storage facilities that could be drawn out later on, or even store electricity at off-peak prices and use them during peak periods. So that way you're able to kind of cut down on your peak bills. So that's one thing. So clearly, we're seeing a very healthy demand growth for grid storage applications as well. And in fact, for the next 2 years, we see almost half of that demand coming from, or half of that capacity to be built just within California alone. So various economies across the globe are considering expanding their grid storage facilities, mainly because to address the renewable energy intermittency. So as we see a growth in wind and solar power facilities as well, you would also see a growth in grid storage facilities because we cannot predict when we would when the wind would blow, or we can't predict when the sun is going to shine the most, and we can't predict when the cloud is going to come and disrupt that. So because to kind of manage the intermittency, you need storage, and that's why you're seeing that growth in demand for grid storage facilities as well.
Thank you, Anand. That was a fascinating insight into the world of battery technology and the potential of hydrogen fuel cells and the obstacles still facing that technology. For more insights and views on disruptive technology like the battery value chain and other long-term themes, please visit elgimetf.com or elgimblog.com. Thank you all very much for listening, and thank you, Anand, for your time.
Thank you very much, Rob. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.